Robert Bruce here. I'm back with Brian Clark for the second Q&A, second part of the content Q&A. We've got a couple more of these left to do. We're going through the questions that you all generously submitted to us. Last time we ran through a good handful of them, got through about half of them. This time we're going to finish out the rest of the questions relating to content. Today's episode of Entreproducer is brought to you by Authority, which is Copyblogger's new content marketing training that's designed to help you become a content marketing expert for less than a dollar a day. Content, content, content. It seems it's all you're hearing about these days, even in this very podcast where the vast majority of your questions centered around the topic of content. How do you create it? How do you create the right kind of content to market your business, product, or idea? And once you create it, how do you get it shared? How does content actually grow a business, and how can you measure it? We get these questions all the time. And this stuff that we're talking about, even on this podcast, just the tip of the iceberg. And now we'd like to take you behind the scenes for an even closer look at this stuff, an even deeper education. And right now, there's over 60 hours of this kind of audio and video training available to Authority members, as well as instant access to nearly 100,000 words of marketing training contained in 13 different ebooks. And that's just the beginning. We're doing ongoing monthly seminars, video presentations, monthly Q&A sessions with Copyblogger staff and outside experts. We've got an interactive forum that's for networking and delivering personal answers to your questions. So that's it. Less than a dollar a day. We're putting everything we have into Authority, and I'd like you to go check out the details over at getauthority.net. That's getauthority.net. If you understand that content marketing is not just another annoying buzzword, but a long-term, more than 100-year-old marketing strategy that can be the future of your business, please check out Authority. Brian, let's get to these questions.
Thank you, Paul Harvey.
Question number one. How do you optimize photos and illustrations for search?
You know, that used to be a bigger deal. I never really put a lot of thought into it. Basically, you know, you tie your keywords, obviously, to the subject of the photograph if it is, you know, literally tied, not one of your abstract photos, Robert, but literally tied to the subject matter that you're discussing. Now, this used to be a, you know, ranking well in Google image search ended up bringing you traffic. I always thought it was of dubious quality. But now Google image search has changed to the point where they now show you the image without them having to visit the page at all. So, and this has been a pretty recent development. It's basically tying in keywords into the actual image file name, but the benefits are pretty low, so don't overthink it.
All right, next question. How often or how many articles should you post to a blog?
Enough, but not too much.
Next question.
No, I mean, that's, you know, there is no magic number. Copyblogger was started with two really high quality articles a week, and that's how it grew, which was against the conventional wisdom of the time, which said you had to post every day. There was a lot of conventional wisdom of the time that Copyblogger turned on its head. Now we publish five or six times a week, even though, you know, we slow down during the summer. On the other hand, you have people like John Morrow, you have Derek Halpern, you've got Tim Ferriss. These guys are saying only publish when you've got something super epic. And then, of course, Halpern's philosophy is, you know, publish less and promote more. Spend all your time promoting a high-quality piece of content, and you'll get more traction. So it really depends on your business. From a search engine perspective, with a young site, you need to get above a certain threshold of content on that site to even really catch Google's attention. But it's really about attracting, sharing, and links, right? So if you can attract more shares and links with four epic articles a month as opposed to four a week, then you probably should do it that way.
Yeah, and another way to look at it might be not so much how often should you publish, but what the quality of what you publish. What should you publish? And this, I'm thinking of our content landing pages, which are very, very powerful. Obviously, you have to create content that pushes and links back to those kind of pillar pages. In our case, we have a content marketing page, a copywriting 101 page, landing page page. But isn't it also a thing of what you publish?
No, of course. That's really the essence. I think consistency over the long term is what makes the difference. And that's exactly what people end up messing up. They quit, or they're inconsistent, or they're not getting enough traction. They're just publishing in a vacuum without any sort of way of getting the word out, which at the beginning, you know, that's the job. But as your audience grows, you get to the minimum viable audience, they start growing the audience for you, among other great things. So you've got to get to that point where you've got enough of an audience to where their sharing and or linking is becoming a catalyst for organic growth.
Next question. Here's something we were just talking about a little bit earlier. Should you build a personal brand or a company brand with content? And makes the point of, for example, when I think of pro blogger, I think of Darren Rouse. If he's gone, I doubt I'd check pro blogger ever again. Brings up other sites and personalities like Rand Fishkin over at SEO Moz or Leo Babauta at Zen Habits. Go personal or go company as far as the branding?
Well, I always made it a point to build the brand of the company, of the blog first, and then, you know, us and our individual product brands instead of myself. I was one of the first people to embrace outside contributors. I really wanted Copyblogger to be like a magazine, not a one-person blog. That said, to this day, Copyblogger is a euphemism for Brian Clark. I mean,
you're going to say you're actually called Copyblogger.
I know.
Publicly.
It's ridiculous. I did not really want that. But, you know, in the process of creating something for others, both your personal brand and the brand of whatever it is you're building naturally grow. If you focus on providing value, whether it's under your own name or under a brand that you've developed, that's what matters. And if you do that, I think all ships start to rise equally when it comes to personal brand and product brands or content brands. So I don't like the term personal branding. It's just a word for your reputation. In this context, it's a reputation for delivering value. And it happens if you do that. And that's the most I think about my personal brand.
Yeah. And there's, I think, a long-term issue here too. Like, only two kids in a California garage would call a company Google, you know, and now it's such a well-known name, obviously, that it doesn't matter, you know, kind of like the Beatles is one of the stupidest band names ever, but it doesn't matter because they're the Beatles. So yeah. In that, you know, it's a little bit of a sideways thing here, but whether it's your name or your company name, obviously that's got to do with what your goals are and what market you're serving. But in some sense, in a larger sense, it doesn't really matter in the long game.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of stupid brands, Copyblogger, I mean, we were just talking about that if we could start over now, we might choose something different. But it doesn't matter. Copyblogger stands for something in the minds of people, and that's all that matters. It doesn't really matter if it's Google or Yahoo or Copyblogger or the Beatles, because those things all mean something to the respective audience that is bigger than the word.
Using social networking is a great way to build and grow an audience, this next questioner states. But what if I'm working in a health niche that people don't really want to be quote unquote liking or tweeting about publicly or otherwise?
Yeah, yeah. And yet, those are the type of things where people are desperately searching out information. So one way or another, that information will spread among like-minded people. I mean, that's why you have niche internet forums. That's why you have advocacy groups. So this, to me, is a situation where relationship with other publishers is almost more important than the social media aspect. Because you're right, your end user isn't necessarily going to tweet about something like that. At the same time, though, that person is out there searching all the relevant, you know, publications and information about that affliction, if you will. So links in between resources that address that become the most important navigation. That's the old school internet. That's how it worked, right? Before social media. That's still valid. And Google still ranks those type of highly relevant authoritative links more than anything. So in that context, you focus on what works. You know, for a lot of us, social media is a catalyst that gets you to that end goal of links anyway, right? So if it's not there, it doesn't mean you still can't get the direct traffic and then the search engine rankings that you're looking for that type of stuff. Because anytime there's a problem, and that type of ailment is definitely a problem, you've got people searching for information.
Next question. How do you bring content into the real world? And this person actually gives a really good example. Say there's a yoga teacher that has classes every week, and he gains new fans through, you know, publishing on his or her website. But this person says, I produce a podcast for live sound engineers and don't have a regular place to promote it alternately in the real world. I wonder if that's...
Take a stab at it, Robert, because I'm not sure I understand the question.
Yeah, there's two ways. So we can see the benefit of online content to help a brick and mortar business. But this person is asking, I do this podcast and I want to get it out to the real world people, in this case, live sound engineers. Right. And I'm wondering if it's even a distinction, because if your podcast is good, if you're providing great content, useful information, entertaining stuff through that podcast that those people are already searching for and looking for as it is, you know, where are live sound engineers? They're online. They're going to be searching for those things.
And, I mean, there's magazines that address that industry. There's conferences, all that kind of stuff. I mean, you got to work the real world relationships. In this day and age, I mean, there's a niche for everything and there are people actively looking for it. And that stuff is shared on social media. I mean, any geeky topic is... You know, that's what Google Plus is really aiming for, and that people didn't get at the beginning, that it's a content topical network, not so much a social network. Obviously, it's driven by people, but it's about shared interest. So I would go do a search on Google Plus, find the people in that field, circle them up, start interacting with them, start a community. I started a Google Plus community for online content producers, and I never did anything with it. And there are people in there every day, you know. I didn't even promote it. I didn't do anything, because people search for what they're interested in, and then they join communities and do all that kind of stuff. So you've got to put yourself at the center of a community one way or another. If you can't start it yourself, then you have to participate at a meaningful level until you're regarded as someone to listen to. And of course, if you're someone to listen to, and you're doing a podcast, you're going to get people tuning in.
Next question from a musician. If people aren't buying music anymore, what are other ways I can create value with my art? This goes back to a question last week about writing fiction, where basically your answer was, at this point, put it out there. I use Sherlock Holmes. Who did you use as an example?
Dickens?
Yeah, Charles Dickens. But yeah, your answer was put it out there. You know, you have to think carefully about that, and you have to look at your industry for what's going on. I mean, in this particular case, I'd send this person over to Bob Lefsetz. It's a great newsletter that talks about this stuff day in and day out. But generally, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know if I'm a weirdo or not. I mean, I have a Spotify subscription, but I still buy music all the time. I just do. If I like something, then I support.
So you're downloading files from iTunes and whatnot.
Yeah, I buy everything. I buy everything through iTunes. Yeah, I mean, I've got a file cabinet full of CDs. And if it wasn't good enough for me to burn to iTunes, then it wasn't good enough.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, this is tough. And reading, what is it, Lefwitz?
Lefsetz, Bob Lefsetz, L-E-F.
Bob Lefsetz, yeah.
S-E-T-Z.
If you're a musician, you got to subscribe to that. I mean, his thinking is very parallel to ours, except he is a music industry insider. But, you know, usually the mantra now is that if the music's free, then what can you sell? You can sell live performances. You can sell merchandise. It's always kind of been that way for artists because unless you were a superstar, you didn't make money off record sales. You had to tour, right? That's why Wilco used to be such road warriors because they didn't make any money off their albums. You know, I mean, bands like that. So it's a tough business. You know, I wish I was a musician just for the joy of it. I know that's not the answer anyone wants to hear, but you know, I regret that I can't play an instrument and hope to remedy that at some point, but I don't think I'd ever try to make money doing it. So,
yeah, I've got a friend who just releasing some singles, and it's been an interesting process, largely finding that it's a situation where it's pay what you want. You can download the file, but it's also available streaming. Hardly any downloads. People are very willing to donate, so to speak. Hardly any downloads, mostly streaming. But then you look, too, into situations like if it's out there, if it starts spreading, if it gets passed around, word of mouth, of course, being the main thing, most powerful thing, you know, you can look into indirect ways to take care of some things financially, like licensing. So anyway, check out Bob.
Well, you know, the key here, when you give away free content, whether it be music or articles or ebooks or whatever, the key is that you have to establish an ongoing relationship with your fans. So if no one wants to pay, then, you know, trade in, you know, download for an email address and promise them that they'll be the first to know next time you release something. And then after that, you got to get creative about what will they pay for. What if you did a streaming broadcast of a live performance and charge people or ask for donations? Or, you know, I mean, it's a tough question. There's no doubt about it. But, you know, people love music and they love the people who make that music. So that's all you need to make money somehow. It just takes a lot of creativity beyond the creativity it takes to make the music.
All right, we're going to pick up the pace here, Mr. Clark, because I want to get through all of these questions. So let's get to this next one. Would you rather have a business that had multiple revenue streams or this might be an obvious question. Would you rather sell one high-end product a year?
That second model makes me nervous, but there are a lot of people who do quite well with it in the B2B space. I mean, a good B2B salesperson can make one deal a year and that's their year, right? But, you know, having multiple streams of revenue, you know, there's certainly nothing wrong with that. Things change, things ebb and flow. When you have different streams, then you have, you know, you just have that foundational security that a one product or one shot type of thing you don't have. I will say that, you know, to the extent possible, try to figure out a recurring business model so you're not having to hunt down new customers every month. You know, right now, Copyblogger Media is working about half and half between, you know, our hosting and Scribe and Authority, which are recurring, and Studio Press and Premise, which at this point are not. Next year, you will see a rapid acceleration of where we're providing more turnkey complete solutions in which that 50-50 thing will go away. And that's the funny thing is, though, Studio Press continues to grow. So it's, you know, everyone's like, well, transactional, you know, it's transactional, which is one time versus recurring. You know, transactional business models make people nervous, and yet having it is not something I'd say, oh, we don't want to sell that anymore. Let's just give that money away. It doesn't work that way. But I think having multiple lines of business is safer, and a recurring model is the safest of all.
All right. We got a lot of artists in the Entreproducer audience. Were you aware of that?
I was not. They always have the toughest questions too.
Yeah, right. So okay, I'm going to reframe this question. It's similar to the one from last week as well and the music question that we just tackled. But how would you suggest an independent fiction author build an audience? Here's my version of this, and he goes into it a little bit later. But Brian Clark, if you were writing a book right now, just starting to write a book. You had the idea, you knew you wanted to do it. You did not have Copyblogger. You did not have the audience that you have built over the last 7 years. You had nothing, no particular contacts. How would you go about building an audience to then eventually sell that book?
Is this a fiction book or a business book?
I know it's the two can be very different, but let's, for the sake of time, try to meld the two. Let's try to come to a general answer if we can.
Here's what I would do, even though the discussions Robert and I have offline about books would make everyone cringe, because that's why we never write them.
hint.
Yeah. But totally unknown, here's what I would do. I would create, in essence, a video book trailer, which are becoming more and more popular, and Robert is the go-to guy for voiceover for obvious reasons. I would hire Robert Bruce. I'd write a script, and I would make a fascinating video that was tied to whatever, if it's fiction, you know, the story, if it's nonfiction, you know, if it's a Malcolm Gladwell type book, then the most fascinating elements, you know, that I could display. So I would make that, I would promote it to try to get it to go viral to a certain degree. I would have an opt-in that says, get the next installment in this video series. I wouldn't even mention the book, right? It wouldn't be a typical trailer, because a trailer sells a book, right? This would be an extended video serial where there are installments that people want to see the next of. So it's an art form in itself. You know, maybe have 5 episodes and then sell the book. I would love to do that, actually. That would be fun, you know. And we've kind of talked about these things for other projects, Robert. But, you know, I did an article at Marketing Land that was released earlier this week and talked about Upworthy, which is kind of like a BuzzFeed, but for social issues. They're a very left-leaning organization. The guy who founded Move On started this. And they're the fastest-growing media site in the planet. And they curate other people's content. That's the other strategy, which is to do the hard work of finding these great videos with emotional appeal. One way or another, you've got to get people to opt in and follow you, because what you are putting out is so good. So whether you're making the videos or you're curating videos that tell a story related to the ultimate book that you're going to sell, you've got to get an audience, right? And they've got to look forward to hearing from you each time. So when you do announce that book, if you do it correctly, it's a no-brainer. They're buying it. So that's what I would do off the top of my head. That actually sounds like fun.
That's a whole episode. Yeah, I can hear you in your voice. You're like, let's get this podcast done and go do something like that.
Let's go talk about this. And we could do that for some, even with our products. You know, I mean, like what we've got coming next year, I could think of a storyline that might work with that. So anyway, it's all wide open. Just don't do what everyone else is doing. Do something fantastic and get people to sign up to get the next fantastic thing. And that's content marketing right there.
And I will, one final note on that is, you're thinking, this is a whole nother podcast that we promised we would get to at some point, the book podcast, but you're thinking way bigger than a book when you start thinking like that.
And if you do that, you're just getting started with a book. Like, the book sales are the foundation of an entire brand. And again, of course, it depends on what the topic is, whether it's fiction or nonfiction. But yeah, I always think very big from the beginning. And if all you end up doing is selling the book, hey, mission accomplished. That was your goal. But if you do it the right way, you often find that there are boundless other opportunities from what you've done, because you were doing something incredibly remarkable while building a direct audience.
6 more questions. What happens when content marketing becomes so mainstream that you're one of many producing quality, informative, valuable content in your industry?
Hey, welcome to my world. What do you think it's like in the content marketing world? I mean, yes, we were early. We talked about it, you know, 7.5 years ago, and now we're the largest content marketing blog on the planet. But everyone who talks about content marketing out there is pretty good, right? I mean, you know, the stuff Robert tweets from, you know, other companies that sell software or consultants or whatever, I'm like, yeah, that's good. So what I always use the space that Copyblogger plays in as an example of what it might look like someday for everyone. So right now, you may not have to go all out like we do in your industry, but it doesn't hurt to aim high and set the bar so high that your competitors are intimidated by how good you are. What does Sonya call it in that post she did? You know, you have to be shockingly great, or I can't remember. You know, Sonya always says everything perfectly. It's annoying.
Right, right. It pisses me off.
Shockingly good, or I don't know. Assume that it will be that way and be the industry setting standard right now. You know, go above and beyond what you have to do. You might not have to do that to succeed, you know, but I like to set some distance between me and our so-called competition. And a lot of the way I do that is with content, but I also do it by not really having competition, because you're thinking about things differently and you have an audience that they don't have. And it becomes really, you know, an unfair advantage. I say that all the time as a good thing. But I think there's an opportunity for a lot of people in a lot of industries right now to be that industry leader to the point where you're just blowing everyone away. I think that's what people should aim for if you're going to do this. Because why not? Why not be the best as opposed to just good enough?
What's the future of SEO?
It's already here. It's content marketing. It is authorship. It is the combination of industry, authority, content that is shared, linked to by authors, writers, content creators, with demonstrated expertise. I mean, Matt Cutts, every time he does a video, just go watch what he says. All I've done since 2005 is listen to what Google said and assume that one day they'll make it come true. You know, for a long time, the copy blogger way that we were preaching wasn't actually necessary because Google wasn't there yet. And so a lot of smart people in the SEO industry decided to continue to take shortcuts. Then Panda hits, then Penguin hits, and the game's over. And now they're all calling themselves content marketers. So all I did was trust Google to one day get there and act accordingly. And it worked out so well because I did SEO as if, you know, I was going to lose Google and it didn't matter. Well, really, I should say I published content as if search engines didn't exist. Because, and if they didn't, if I never got Google traffic, I'd still have the direct audience. And that's really the most valuable thing. That's why I always talk about that search engine rankings are the icing on the cake. But because I followed that methodology, we have great search engine rankings. You know, Google is our largest source of traffic. We kill it in Google. So it's here, you know, it is. The content that people like, Google is getting much better at identifying that. Google Plus is the next step in that. Authorship is here already. And whether anything called author rank ever materializes, you know, I already kind of enjoy whatever author rank might be just because I built up authority in a subject matter. And my site built up authority around those relevant topics: content marketing, copywriting, landing pages, email marketing, which is highly competitive and we're on the first page for. So I think what you're seeing right now is SEO. You still have to do the on-page stuff, but that's minor and that can be done at any time. You don't even have to do it out of the gate.
Let's say somebody has been building a blog about 5 years, maybe a little more than 5 years, and things are okay, but it's on a very specific topic, but they're still struggling with, you know, traffic and subscribers. They're still struggling with building an audience 5 years later. Now, the problem with this question is that we can't look at, you know, a site specifically and see what, there could be any number of things going on there, from the quality of the content to, you know, conversion issues with design. But generally, for someone who says that they're taking copy bloggers' advice, they're still struggling 5 years later with building an audience. Let me ask this in a different way, Brian. If you, let's say 6 months into or a year into writing and producing copy blogger, it just wasn't working. What kinds of things would you have looked at that would have led to a decision of what to do?
I think the problem here is probably just a lack of effective content promotion. Because if you've been blogging for that long, you know, you're probably doing okay in search just by, you know, writing about a specific topic for consistently over time. But, you know, during the first three, it was compressed for me. I couldn't do anything differently than what I did. During the first 3 months of Copy Blogger, I had two big creative ideas that completely flopped. And then the third one I tried is what broke through. If it didn't happen at that point, I just would have kept going. You know, this whole concept of agile content development, you know, feedback and iteration. We're in a real-time environment. If you get enough people to see your content, you'll get a reaction, which will give you guidance on what to do next. I think a lot of people just don't get enough exposure to any one piece of content, so they don't know if it worked or not, right? And that without that kind of feedback, you are completely flying blind. I mean, I'll give you an example that's more recent. You know, my Boulder site that I started, I guess it's been 6 months ago now, it's amazing. And Erica, you know, we'll be around in Boulder and people will talk about our site. Well, it's my site, but she works on it without knowing it's us because we have been so effective at building an audience. It's got something like 8,200 Facebook likes after 6 months, you know, because it's very relevant to the audience we're trying to serve. And we've done our groundwork. First of all, hiring someone like Erica, who is well-connected and active on social media, obviously. That's why a certain type of writer with authority, you know, is more valuable than just someone who can string together words. The content we create is not difficult on the Boulder site. It is local lifestyle content, nowhere near the level of craft and expertise that we do on Copy Blogger. But it's the right content for the audience, and we got the word out to where it didn't depend on my reputation as that guy who started Copy Blogger. It's just the site and what it does for the audience. So that's a very long answer, but I went through the same process with this local site that I did at the beginning of Copy Blogger. You've got to pay attention and see what people are into and then give them more of that.
I like how this next questioner positions him or herself. I'm a fiction author entrepreneur, but they ask, what kind of content should I produce to build an audience before releasing, say, a supernatural mystery thriller? And I'm going to take a stab at this because this is close to
home. Dude, that's the video series I just talked about. Just imagine. Yep.
I had one other thought on this because this is something I'd do if I wasn't so damn busy with my day job. You know, fiction in particular to me presents an incredible opportunity at the moment, I think, which is you've got a self-defined group of people that are absolutely insane for whatever crime, romance, historical fiction, whatever the genre is. They're already predefined. They're already out there waiting for incredible, useful, entertaining, great content to supplement, you know, the books that they're reading and the world that they want to live in. So supernatural mystery thriller. I mean, one thought I've had is, you know,
How we always talked about doing an alternate reality game to promote?
Yes.
Exactly that kind of book. I mean,
exactly.
You know, I mean, it's kind of daunting, you know, and it takes a lot of thought. But, you know, you could do one of these whodunit style alternate reality game kind of things. And it's not necessarily expensive. It just takes a lot of creativity and a way to get the word out. So I might do a trailer that promotes the game, and then the game promotes the book. Mm-hmm. Because the only way you can figure out the ending is by reading the book. That would be awesome.
Yeah, you're definitely a producer, director type. Another thought I had though was building a site around that niche, you know, with content that those people want, both stuff that's in, stuff in the news, writing articles about what's going on. I know there's a site. I'm gonna have to check this, but it's, I think it's crimeculture.com. I'll look it up. But anyway, it's really high end articles on. Both fiction and nonfiction events, things going on, but they've been around a handful of years. But something like the traffic was insane. I'll find it. I'll put it in the show notes. But this is a, you know, imagine if a site like that with that kind of authority, you know, the person was also writing fiction or writing whatever. I mean, there's a bunch of ways that you can go at this. What if you had, I don't know, the best supernatural mystery thriller podcast in iTunes. I can't here go through what that might mean.
That's a great idea. Like you do reviews, discussion.
That's right. Look at how powerful these talk shows are and podcasts in general. But so focusing down, you can either go like, you know, go Hollywood like Brian, but there's also a million other ways, you know, I think to get this done, especially when you're looking at these niche things. So next question. Two more here. I'm hearing a backlash about content marketing, that it's time and talent expensive. You know what? These last two questions are essentially the same. I didn't catch this before. So anyway, what's the cost, the true cost, let's say, of content marketing, both in financial terms and time and talent terms?
This question kind of gets to me because, you know what's expensive? Producing a 30-second commercial that brings no sales, buying TV airtime, buying even radio airtime for a TV, a radio commercial that's not a direct response ad that gets someone to do something. And that's been going on for decades, but no one complained about that. That was just lovely, right? It's completely ineffective, completely untrackable, and people are just throwing money down the garbage, right? And, you know, you need talent to film a commercial, you need talent to create a magazine ad, you need voice talent for the radio, you need, you know, people to write scripts that aren't cheap. This is way less expensive than anything that's come before and more effective, but I think there was a certain segment that thought it was free. Like it didn't cost anything, you know? Anything that you create that is worthwhile takes talent. And talent has an expense tied to it. But, you know, I mean, we've been talking with bringing on, you know, freelance writers for Copyblogger. And the amount that we pay is generous in the industry. And yet, to me, I think it's incredibly cheap because I know the value that I'm getting out of each of those pieces of content. Now, the writer is getting value that's acceptable to them, too. But compared to like me doing pay-per-click, $10,000, $20,000 a month, I don't get it. It only just, and I'm not trying to be insulting to the person who asked the question because it's just, you know, a lack of perspective perhaps that you don't realize how much money was thrown down the drain on interruption advertising.
Yeah. And by the way, when you turn those checks off, when you stop writing those checks, you know, you stop getting the flow.
It's over because you're tapping into someone else's media stream instead of building your own. I mean, the value of what we have with the direct relationship with our audience, I don't even know how to quantify it. I mean, I don't even know, like if we ever sold the company, I don't think I'd ever be satisfied with whatever that amount was because they would probably not get how valuable just the site is. I mean, we've had multi-million dollar offers just for the site. And that was a few years ago. It's worth more every year. I don't know. It's just a different way of thinking. It is nowhere near the expense that other forms of ineffective advertising are. But I think people just have to come to grips, especially with authorship and the rise of the online content creator. And yeah, there's a cost associated with it, and I wouldn't skimp on it if you actually want to make money. I mean, everything online is completely trackable. That's why the advertising online banner ad industry is collapsing. Everyone knows it doesn't work, right? We have the data. There's no more Nielsen raid. I mean, do you know how that works, Robert? It's such a scam, right? I mean, now we know who clicked, we know who bought, we know everything, and it just does not work. But content marketing does work. So time and talent to design a banner ad that gets ignored, those aren't cheap either. So I'm just trying to give some perspective here. Yes, anything worth doing, unless you're doing it all yourself, which is a great way to get started if you're an actual writer or content creator, then it's an investment of time, lots of time. You know, I talk about the fact that I started Copyblogger with $1,000, but my time was worth way more than that that first year and a half before I made money. Doesn't matter. It all paid off in the end. So I have no regrets about that.
Yeah. And by the way, you don't need to be anywhere near the size of a copy blogger to get serious things done in whatever your market is. There's a lot of stuff you can do on a much smaller scale, depending on the market, depending on what your goals are, depending on what your needs are. I'm going to bring, we keep bringing him up because it's just such a great story, but I'm going to bring, I think Marcus Sheridan on here. I'm going to ask if he'll come on. You know, there's a guy who essentially had his small pool business, a brick and mortar pool business. And as far as I know, I'll clear this up if I'm wrong about it, but one guy answering the questions of his customers, posting them to a blog, essentially, grew from there and he's doing other things now. But that's what turned his business around. And whether you have an existing business or you're more of a consultant, freelance type, you know, you don't have to have scale to a massive size in order to get some real stuff done.
Oh, yeah. I mean, my Boulder site, you know, just all I have to do is keep going and it's going to own the town, but it'll never have an audience the size of Copyblogger. There aren't 191,000 people in Boulder. There's only 60,000 if you don't count the you know, the college kids who are gone for the summer. So, but how much is this local economy? How much business could be done with a site that can get into real estate? You can get into local marketing services, native advertising. I mean, you don't need a huge audience. You need to be relevant to enough of an audience within a niche or a space or a geographic area in order to do business. And that's always going to be different. But I mean, getting back to the same point, the amount of money I see, our overhead compared to our revenue, thanks to content, makes the expense of it not worth considering. I'll just leave it at that.
All right, we're coming back. Might be one more in this Q&A series, might be two, depending on, we went pretty a little bit long today for our standards anyway. We're going to look at business structure questions, revenue questions, and then basic tools and things that we use to get things done kind of questions. Two different categories that I broke that up in. And if you want the full deal, I mean, again, I said in the beginning, this is the tip of the iceberg. We're answering as many as we can, but this is really just an introduction in a lot of cases to some of these ideas. The real deal is over at Authority, and that's at getauthority.net. Brian, you got anything to add before I 86 you for the day?
Well, the cool thing about the Authority Q&As, and you know, not even counting the forum where those are very personalized, direct, specific answers, you know, none of us do consulting, but you ask us a specific question about your business and I'll give you the best idea I have, you know, and that is perfectly fine with me. So it's you know, at some point, I mean, I think there's 3,000 people in there now. We're going to have to raise the prices. But so far, I mean, everyone's loving it and I couldn't be more pleased. I know Sonia's ecstatic because she lives for this type of community. This is what she was born to do. So anyway, I saw someone, I think it was Joanna, on the last podcast, left a comment and said, you know, I'd pay for these podcasts. I'm like, well, you could pay for better than these podcasts over at Authority if you really wanted to. But we'll continue to do this and answer questions. And then we're going to get back into interview mode. I've got some cool business model stuff coming for you guys. So either way, we're here for you in whatever capacity you're looking for.
You know, one way you could pay, so to speak, for Entreproducer Podcast. If you love this podcast, look us up in iTunes and go give us a rating. 5 stars are the best. There's no question. But
I think that's the only option.
But we, yeah, right. In this case, that's probably the only option. But no, if you like what's going on here, go give us an honest rating, whatever that may be. We appreciate it. That helps us in the iTunes algorithm and all that, and helps spread the word. So, Brian, I'm gone. Later.
Out of here.